Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
In my Father's house are many mansions, said Jesus. And in the house of Christianity there are many mansions, surely. The largest is the Roman Catholic Church. But if you stand outside looking in at that mansion, you hear a lot of tumultuous noise. There are problems, there are disagreements, and at the same time, you hear many voices rising in unison in a chorus of appreciation for the faith and of deep inner commitment to the faith. It persists, even though the church has been heavily buffeted in this country, surely, in recent years. My guests are all loyal Catholics. Michael Corrin is a Canadian and a very important man in Canadian broadcasting, the author of a number of books. The newest is titled Why Catholics Are Right. I don't know why that doesn't have an exclamation point at the end, but that's the way that book is written. Patrick McCloskey is a journalist, has recently become a faculty member at Loyola, and has done a very interesting book about Catholic education, particularly focusing on a Catholic school in Harlem in New York, titled The Street Stops Here, A Year at a Catholic High School in Harlem. And the Reverend Thomas Bima is provost. That's what you used to be. What's the current title?
I'm in July 1st, I'll become vice rector for
becomes academic vice
affairs.
Rector of the now, of the
of Mundelein Seminary.
Of Mundelein Seminary, which is, of course, within the University of St. Mary of the Lake.
Yes.
In Mundelein,
right.
Illinois.
It's the major seminary of the Archdiocese.
And he is also the editor of a new volume titled What is a Parish? Canonical, Pastoral, and Theological Perspectives. I think one has to begin with the faith and the very nature of the faith. And Father, I'm going to ask you to give the basic summary of what all Catholics are required to believe. That, I think, is represented by the Apostles' Creed.
Right, and it's actually more than all what Catholics would believe. All traditional Christians,
to be sure,
mere Christians, as C.S. Lewis would call them, would say that the Apostles' Creed mm-hmm. is the basic touchstone, which is, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried. And the third day he rose again from the dead. He is descended into hell. Now you've got me. He ascended into heaven and sits at the right hand of the Father. From thence he shall come to judge the living and the dead. Believe in the Holy Spirit, the Holy Catholic Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and life everlasting. So there you have 12 basic articles that form the dogmatic basis of Christianity's claims, which we can talk about a little more.
And one of those, and back to the very last one, you believe in the resurrection of the flesh and life eternal. By golly, that would be profoundly satisfying if I could believe it, but I fear I don't.
Well, in fact, Milt, actually, that last article is really the one that Christianity hangs everything on, because you can't really understand Christianity if you don't understand all of it in this context, that this life is not all there is, that the promise that Jesus Christ offers to us is life eternal. And that really is the starting point. It's the end of the creed, but it's the starting point of the faith.
An old hymn goes, I'm just a poor wayfarer and stranger traveling through this world of woe. Mm-hmm. And there's no sickness, toil, or trouble in the land to which I go.
There you have it.
This is only the land of shadows. Real life hasn't begun yet, to quote C.S. Lewis,
yeah.
Actually. My end is my beginning, Mary Queen of Scots. The problem of what happens afterwards is really one for the atheists. They believe that we are food for worms, we are dust at death. They have to then deal with issues such as why is there suffering in this world? Why do good people suffer? Why do bad people have often wonderful lives? This is not a problem for the Christian, not a problem for the Catholic. God doesn't guarantee a good life, he guarantees a perfect eternity. And we've been accused as serious Christians. I like to use the word serious, whether it's Catholic or Protestant, serious or not serious about your faith. We've been accused of holding on to this as some sort of support because we're weak people. Some of us are weak people. Some of us are very strong people. That's really irrelevant. It's an emotional argument. Is it true or not? And I believe it is true. I believe that Jesus Christ was crucified, was seen dead. There's everyone who lived in the past was an idiot theory that many modern thinkers have. And so those men and women around Jesus who knew death on a personal basis saw death every day. Today we don't see death. We're terrified of death. When they saw Jesus, they got it wrong. He wasn't really dead. He wasn't really crucified. And when they saw him alive again, they got it wrong. They were just having a bad day. You know, they had a bad breakfast or whatever. No, they saw him, and most of them went to their deaths with a smile. People die for the wrong reasons, but because they've been misled. They saw him. They knew it was true. The resurrection was true. Everything he said was true. Thus, by relationship with him and by membership of the church he founded, the Roman Catholic Church, we are guaranteed an eternity with God our Father in heaven.
When you title your book, and the book as written certainly justifies the title, when you title your book, Why Catholics Are Right, are you thereby asserting that nobody else is as right as Catholics are?
You put it very well, sir. I am. It's not why Catholics are right and why everybody else should be beaten up. My parents weren't Catholic. God rest their souls.
Your father was Jewish.
My father was Jewish. He was secular, against organized religion, partly because of his experience as a Jewish man in the 1950s, marrying a non-Jewish woman. In Britain, remember, not as pluralistic, I suppose, as North America. But they were lovely people who, when I became a Catholic, I remember my mother saying, if it makes you happy, just don't tell us about it.
Yep.
Which was really quite good, really. But the book, I believe in exclusive truth, as surely anyone does. Other people, there are degrees of wrongness. Evangelicals are only slightly wrong. Atheists are completely wrong. But on issues of faith and morality, yes, the Roman Catholic Church is right.
Are Jews and Muslims completely wrong?
I think Judaism and Christianity have much in common, and Judaism, of course, is the parent, the mother, father of Christianity. Yeah. But I believe that Islam is an extremely is a contrary religion. At the center of Christianity and Judaism is love for life. The dietary laws, many of the most fundamental laws of Judaism, do not have to be observed if life is to be preserved. Christianity is the same. Life is at the very center. I don't believe Islam has that concept. I think it's one of submission and power.
Now, Father Baima has been involved, I know from looking at your some of your material, in ecumenical work.
And interfaith work, yeah.
And would you agree with that, that kind of judgment of the other peoples, the other religions of the book, Judaism and Islam?
I certainly agree with the characterization of Judaism. Judaism is our past, and you can't understand Christianity without understanding that it emerges out of the Jewish faith. And so there can't be a sharp division in our understanding between Christianity and Judaism because it's so essential to interpret everything about Christianity. So the relationship Christianity has to Judaism is unlike its relationship to any other of the world religions. Beyond that, I would say that, you know, as a scholar, you know, who's worked in interreligious dialogue, I find it difficult to make global statements about one religion or another, because they all are fairly sophisticated in the way they deal with their own tradition, but they're also very local. And so the way we might experience Islam here in Chicago is very different than it's experienced in Nigeria or other parts of the world. So it's difficult to get at a pure tradition that we can make global statements
which
about.
Would
so
have,
that's the qualification.
Which would you have more respect for, Islam or modern Unitarianism, taking Unitarianism as a faith of sorts which has only one precept, and as it was once defined, that precept is there is at the most one God, and that's it?
The way I look at the theological status of another religion, of course, is as a Catholic Christian, and I look what truths of the Apostles' Creed that I just, you know, recited most of for you, you know, that they would hold. And the one thing, of course, that Islam does lay claim to is the belief in the God of Abraham. Mm-hmm. Now, we have some problems.
It's rather contemptuous or at least critical of Christianity for the triune nature of God.
Yeah.
They say they are the true monotheists and you are not.
Right. But we are still talking about the God of Abraham. The question is which one of us has the correct understanding of that God?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we maintain that the God of Abraham is tripersonal, is the Trinity, and all that. So there's a lot of work to be done there. But
to a secularist who's very interested in religion but has no commitments to anything, though has, of course, a kind of a nostalgic loyalty to, or more than that, an identity with Judaism as my background. But with all of that said, the question that inevitably comes to my mind, and I pose it just as we're about to run away for a batch of commercials, and Michael will understand that's a basic radio trick.
It's a wonderful thing.
Keeps them hanging. That the question that comes to my mind is, does God agree with you that yours is the right faith, the most right faith, and that others may be mistaken and may be, in fact, close to being incorrect and close to being essentially heretical or worse? How does God view the religions of man? Is the question I am raising. Looking forward to your response after we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We will get down to more practical discussion of what's happening in the Catholic house shortly, in that Catholic mansion. But since I was foolish enough to put that impossible question to you, I'm eager to hear your possible answers, or your plausible answers. What does God make of the diversity of human religions?
The way I would come at that as a Catholic theologian, of course, is to say that Christianity is a revealed religion. That's our starting point. We start with what we understand God has disclosed to us about himself, about his nature and our nature, and about his will for us. This is principally seen when a Catholic says revelation, he means two things, basically: the history and experience of the people of Israel and the person and event of Jesus Christ. This is what we mean by the term revelation. This is recorded for us in the sacred scriptures, but it principally was a historic event. And in reflection on that event, we have access to the disclosure of God and ourselves. So that's our starting point, is that this is not a religion that emerges out of insight or human cleverness. It's given to us, and our stance is to receive it. So we would come to your question saying, well, that's where we're starting. We're starting with what God has told us about religion.
Patrick McCloskey, what would you do with that same question? God's view of the diversity of human religion.
Well,
doesn't God have views? I'm anthropomorphizing God, and I'm asking about his views. Is it possible that God doesn't have views?
Well, I'm, as a journalist, I haven't interviewed him yet, but
I
put a call in, you know. Honestly, from a theological point of view, I was trained as a philosopher, not a theologian. Although I have faith, I kind of look at things from a philosophical point of view in that, as Mortimer Adler on your show in the 1990s, which I remember, and Anthony Flew, who was the great atheist of the entire 20th century, put it, they came down on the side of theism from a philosophical point of view and admitted that Christianity, all the truths of Christianity, are indeed possible, and would have said that many of the so-called truths of the secular and materialist world that are put forward, like full-blown materialism, are utterly impossible. And that revealed religion from, as Anthony Flew put it, is very appealing. Because we can only go so far with reason. Reason leads to faith, and I think that's the major thing. I come at it from reason, and reason leads to the threshold of faith, because we're dealing with the big questions of life, the big mysteries, and where Michael says, you know, Catholicism is right, I kind of come at it as, well, perhaps Catholicism is necessary, in that we are all on the cross, and Christ teaches us the way to live and die.
Michael?
I'm not a priest or an academic, so I can be much nastier than these gentlemen. I believe God disapproves. I am convinced as a Roman Catholic that God left us a church, that Jesus Christ did not leave us a Bible, obviously not, because the church assembled, defined the Bible 300 years after the crucifixion, the resurrection. And the church was left for us, the magisterium, the papacy. You go to Banias, to Caesarea Philippi in northern Israel, and see that enormous great rock, this place of pagan sacrifice where where Christ took Peter 3 or 4 days out of his ministry in Galilee and Judea and said, now you are the rock. You are in charge now. And the church is there to guide us back to its founder, God. And when we reject that church, I don't believe there is enormous celebration and happiness in heaven. What has developed is any number of other religions and any number of denominations outside of Catholicism within Christianity. There are more than 22,000 Protestant denominations. And what tends to happen is that people say, I don't want the church. I want a personal relationship with Christ, which is essential. But what they do, instead of letting themselves become more like Christ, they make Christ resemble them, which is why we now have, for example, the Princess Diana Bible. And we really do. That's not a joke. They had different Bibles, different translations to make all sorts of people feel good about themselves. So I can sit here, especially as a Canadian, and be very liberal about this and say, well, there are different ways and different paths. And no, I believe the Roman Catholic Church is the revealed truth of God. And outside of that, membership of organizations, religions outside of that is not something that God would rejoice in. That doesn't mean he rejects. And as I mentioned earlier, my parents weren't Catholic. Most of my best friends aren't Catholic. But I don't think I can maintain my position as a consistent Roman Catholic and believe that there are moral and theological equivalents here.
Is my impression in any sense correct as I look on at the Catholic Church and talk to Catholics, talk to some priests I've known, and read some things in contemporary religious life and argument and scholarship? Is my impression in any sense correct, that there is a great deal of dissension on significant matters within the Catholic Church, not perhaps on, well, even on ultimate matters as to the, whether the Apostles' Creed really is to be taken with utter seriousness and with other concretistic certainty. Because I've certainly run into some Catholics, even those who are in orders of one kind or another. Particularly, I was telling you before we began tonight about a night we had with three Chicago nuns, two of whom just laughed it all off and said, we don't believe that stuff anymore, and that isn't what this is all about. Isn't there a theological debate within the Church? Isn't there a great deal of debate on practical issues concerning the governance and the maintenance of the Church? Ordination of women, the continuing question about male priestly celibacy versus marriage, et cetera, et cetera. For outsiders looking in, yours looks like a church which has a lot of fun in a way because a great deal of debate is raging all the time.
Well, I think you're certainly correct. I mean, the fact is that there is a great deal of debate about these things within the church. But if I were to characterize it theologically, there are kind of two camps. There's one that is a more anthropocentric camp that approaches, you know, the various questions really from a more sociological or anthropological approach. And then there's a more Christological camp, which starts at the starting point that I did with this being a revealed religion, that the touchstone has to be Christ, who continues his presence among us through the church, particularly through the sacraments and the sacrament of orders.
So one's Christian, one's sociological. Is that what you're saying?
Well, again, you've taken the position that you're going to be sharper in what you say. But there really are two camps. And, you know, right now there's something of a struggle theologically there.
But I have a revelation, which I get from the very first chapter of Michael Corrin's book. In fact, he's got a leg, or at least a toe, in that other sociological camp.
How dare
and
you
I can I can prove that by reading a crucial paragraph, which I will do directly after we pause for the update on the news. And for that, to the WGN Newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
We are talking about and wandering around in the broad range of issues that come readily to mind when one addresses the modern Roman Catholic Church, particularly as it functions in the United States. My guests are the Reverend Thomas Bima, who is the Vice Rector for Academic Affairs at Mundelein Seminary at the University of St. Mary of the Lake, Patrick McCloskey, who has recently taken a faculty appointment at Loyola University here in Chicago and is the author of the new book, The Street Starts Here, of which we will hear shortly, and Michael Corrin, who is the host of his own nightly Michael Corrin show on CTS Television in Canada, and is the author of a very challenging new book titled Why Catholics Are Right. And I was asserting a moment ago that, in a way, you are also making the pro-Catholic argument from its social utility, not merely from its intrinsic and absolute theological certainty and authenticity. I read a sentence or two from the very first chapter. Quote, "The importance of Catholicism is that in a culture where various forms of religious and aesthetic fundamentalism, crass materialism, and cloying decadence eat away, they all eat away, at civility and civilization, the only permanent, consistent, and logically complete alternative is the Roman Catholic Church." You're saying there, this holds us together. This is necessary for to reverse the trends in an otherwise decadent society. I think you're probably right. I think all good religion, seriously held and well prosecuted and pursued by its those who are in accordance with any given religion, probably live better lives and are better citizens, are better upholders of an ordered, meaningful, and moral existence in which there is respect for civility and respect for social norms than are those who lack all religion, even though some of my best friends are so-called secular humanists who insist they could do it just as well. But I don't think it works just as well for broad mankind, nor do you.
Well, I don't believe you have to be a Catholic to be good. I don't believe you have to believe in God to be good. It's more than about being good or bad. The importance of that, and beautifully read, let me
No, beautifully written.
The Roman Catholic Church is not incidentally or accidentally this institution that is a mirror held up to reflect some of the appalling errors of society. It is that because of its foundation by God. It's not an accident. It's there for a reason. So those people, and there are some very conservative people who embrace the Roman Catholic Church because they see it as a vehicle for stability and conservatism. And that is not enough. I mean, it's nowhere near enough. It's the church founded by God. It's the views of Jesus Christ on earth. But within it being the Christian message and the immutable Christian truth, it is also, because it's founded by God and Christ, it is an institution that shows us the way to live and to behave. If we look at the teachings of the church and the catechism, and you look at that and you think, well, is it flawed? Is it broken? Does it work? If we lived by that, it would be a wonderful world in which to live. And when we look at the history of the church, and I spend some time on that in the book, you'll see that at most, if not all times, even with occasional errors, the church has been on the right side. Sometimes it's taken too long to reach there, but it's been on the right side, showing the errors of society, and particularly so today, because we're being killed with kindness. It's not a vicious dictatorship. It's a benign but still damaging culture where people care more for reality TV than reality, for goodness sake. And the church is something that won't change with the times. You know, the times can be bad just as a person or an ideology can be bad. Truth is not something that can be adapted by the day. It doesn't change with fashion. It's always there.
Let's turn to some of the major institutional areas within the church. One particular very important one, and indeed it's been very important in this city, as it has been in the city of my origin, namely New York City, is the Catholic school system. I am not a graduate of a Catholic school system, though I've occasionally visited them and even lectured once or twice in Catholic schools here in Chicago. The book that we have in hand from Patrick McCloskey is titled The Street Stops Here. I would imagine what you had in mind in inventing that title was The Buck Stops Here on Harry Truman's desk.
Well, that comes to mind, but in point of fact, that's an old saying that goes back many, many decades in Catholic education.
Uh-huh.
And I could trace it back to, I think, St. Agnes School, which was around Grand Central Station. And of course, St. Agnes, like so many schools, or the vast majority of Catholic schools, were built to educate the underclass, to lift, to make an underclass, to lift the underclass into the working class and into the middle class. And the idea being that that whatever's happening in the streets, whatever's happening in mainstream culture, whatever's happening in the home, stops at the front door, and the school becomes a counterculture, an incubator for what the next generation can accomplish. Because you cannot change what's going on at home. You can't, you cannot intervene.
The school that you studied for a year in Harlem was, of course, a school essentially for what we used to call underclass kids. Mm-hmm.
And it always was. It was founded in 1938, Irish Christian Brothers, in an Irish part of Harlem, and always dealt with the poorest of students. In the 60s, it started to transform into a mostly African-American school. So same buildings, same apartment buildings the African-Americans are living in, going to the same school, going through the same process of getting an education and moving up in society.
Basic question, how do the graduates of that school compare to the graduates of the surrounding public schools?
Well, to begin, they all graduate, which is better than, African Americans and Hispanic students have about a 50% graduation rate if you average the boys and girls together. In a neighborhood like that, this is an all-boys school, you might have only a 20% graduation rate to begin with. And then, but those even graduates you might want to classify as close to functionally illiterate for the most part, and very few of those go on to college. Every graduate of Rice High School certainly got into college, or one or two would go into the military. They don't all finish college. That's a long haul and a financial issue. But every student, even the ones that maybe got a little bit of trouble now and then, and I've kept track of them since over the years, they're all doing something productive in life. Many have graduated. Some work for banks, some construction, but they're all doing
something. And a basic methodological question that would instantly come to mind for any social researcher is, were these kids equal in background and in initial competence or initial incompetence to those who went to the public schools surrounding Rice parochial school? Or were they selected in some part because they had greater promise?
For the most part, they're identical. At Rice High School, you have a very high percentage of the American measure of poverty, which would be the free lunch, very high measure of that. As in the public schools, about 90% of the students at Rice would be single parent, mostly female, head of household. I mean, there is some self selection in that someone is the child is pushing to go, or the parent wants the child to go to the high school. But people like Derek Neal, the University of Chicago, have analyzed and waited for self-selection and found that, still you can wait for that and the schools still do make the difference.
How do those schools make the difference? And what does that difference have to do with the Catholic faith as such? These kids are not all or even most of them Catholic, are they?
No. Not an African-American school. Typically, they're mostly non-Catholic. I think it goes back to what Christianity began with, and the Romans thought Christians were nuts because they really believed that everybody was worth something. The whole famous story of St. Lawrence we can get into at another time. But there's intrinsic worth in every human being. And eventually that translates into educating the poor, which began at the end of the 17th century. And then eventually in America you have these massive number of schools educating the poor. Not in an instrumental sort of way, but as a whole child, to the best of their ability, regardless of what they're going to come out to do, with fundamentals in place. There has to be order. There has to be discipline. There has to be basic skills. So there are the traditional sorts of aspects of education firmly in place. And unfortunately, the public schools, which used to do a pretty good job of that, have abandoned that. And that's partly why they don't do as well. The other part is the moral universe really matters.
Yeah. And yet, let me turn to Father Beimon, who's talking about this archdiocese particularly. We keep closing down Catholic parochial schools, and that apparently is a measure of necessity. But why is it? Why, if the system does so well by the kids, and I'm quite convinced it does as well in Chicago, even if we haven't had studies as closely done as this one that Patrick did for the Rice high school in New York. I know just from my own encounters and from journalistic reports and from education guys who've looked into it and written about it either journalistically or academically. We know that our Catholic schools in Chicago turn out far better prepared kids who also do better as they go on into higher education and into professional life and form families, all the rest of that. The differences are quite sizable. Why then is the Catholic parochial school system constricting to the point where if you predict and or extrapolate from the present moment, it might disappear in 50 years?
Let me start with the disclaimer that I'm not an expert, and I'm not with the Catholic School Office, so I don't have all those facts and figures right ahead of me. But I can speak out of some of my own experience, 12 years as a parish priest. One of the first things that is at work is demographic change. I mean, there's a lot of movement in the city of Chicago. For one thing, we know Chicago is a city of active immigration, and we also know that many of the waves of immigration that are coming into the city right now are not Christian. I help out in a village just north of Chicago, Skokie, which has experienced a great deal of ethnic change over the last 25 years. Known kind of nationally as one of the few majority Jewish municipalities, that of course has changed dramatically. There's now 50 primary language groups within the village boundaries. So demographic change is one thing that is affecting our schools, I used to serve in Oak Forest, which is down in the southwest suburbs. And when I was down there, there was this very strong core of Catholics in the southwest suburbs. Well, gradually over the last 25 years, they have migrated west into Homer Township, which is outside the boundaries of the Archdiocese of Chicago. So some of what we're seeing here is demographic movements. And the decrease in one school, or one parish, I should say, is almost equally reflected sometimes in the increase a couple of parishes over as the movement occurs. The school question is a little more complicated, and we were talking before the we came on the air tonight about the dramatic change in the business model of schools from when we had women religious basically staffing the schools, and now the situation of where we have professional lay teachers and what changes that brings about to the business model. But I should defer to Patrick on that point.
Well, the women religious essentially were paid very little, or were not paid.
No, the cost of keeping a convent of religious women to run a school is very, very small. They're basically paid enough to, enough funds went into to keep them going. So tuition at a school might have been $25 a year or, mm-hmm. or something, that sort of thing. So we've gone from 1965, 96% religious, mostly nuns, to about 96% lay. So now we're paying each teacher much, much more.
You're still paying them only about half of what they would get in the public school system, isn't that right?
Well, there's a big gap for sure. But when you and when you put the benefits, match the benefits and salary together, there is a huge gap. Sure. But also they part of the problem is, of course, they bought into the public school credo put forward by the unions that we have to do small class size, which doesn't actually do anything.
Do they order these things differently in Canada?
Yeah, I was incredulous at what you just said. Half the pay. We have fully funded Catholic education in Canada, mm-hmm. and Catholic teachers are paid the same amount, often for, in a way, an easier job, because there's a universal conclusion here. Throughout the world, Catholic education is revered. The elite of Pakistan, I know a little about South Asia, my wife is from South Asia, the elite of Pakistan went to Catholic schools. Go to De La Salle in Jerusalem. It's overwhelmingly Muslim now, but this is a school that so many Muslim middle-class people want to get their children into. I'm from London, the east of London. Forest Gate sounds lovely. It's actually a very rough area. Go to the opening day of one of the leading Catholic schools in the area, and there is a lineup of local black women, single mothers invariably, for 500 yards, lining up to get their children into this Catholic school. throughout the world, Catholic schools are seen as places where there is a chance, a lifeline for kids who otherwise would have none.
I know a wonderful, but rather paradoxical parallel. A friend of mine, he's been a guest on this program often, is an Iranian professor of sociology. That he's Iranian-born, Iranian-educated, mm-hmm. and then came west and is installed in a college here in this area. And he said he got a very good education. He went to the Jewish school in Tehran before he went to college. And that was the elite school that people wanted to get their kids into.
Both traditions revere learning.
Yeah, they do, both of them. And we revere second to learning, or perhaps even prior to learning, we revere, dare I say it, our advertisers. And we're not serving them properly because I'm 5 minutes late, so we pause right now. But gentlemen, I must inform you before we pause, we've got to come to, and indeed this is a very good day to come to, the question of the sexual abuse crisis mm-hmm. in the Catholic Church. This day, because a big report that's been expected for years has just been released this very day from the John Jay College in New York. We'll talk about that as we continue right after these words.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to our three guests for the evening. I'll name them again and name their books again. And then we'll get right down to the question of the sexual abuse crisis and how things have progressed since it broke. Those guests are the Reverend Thomas Bima, Vice Rector for Academic Affairs at the Mundelein Seminary at University of St. Mary of the Lake, Patrick McCloskey, a journalist and now faculty member at Loyola here in town, author of the book The Street Starts Here, Michael Corrin, who is a very significant presence in broadcasting up in Canada and is the author most recently of the book Why Catholics Are Right. What do we know about the report that who commissioned the report, who did the study, and what have they found?
Well, the report was commissioned by the United States Conference of Catholic mm-hmm. Bishops, but it was done by the John Jay College of Law. So it's an external report in this way. Now, I should start by saying I haven't seen the report or read it. I only know what I've seen some reports about it. But first, I'd say this week we had two reports come out. This one on the 18th, but on the 16th, a circular letter was issued by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in Rome, directing all Episcopal conferences throughout the world to put into place significant guidelines on handling sex abuse cases, much as the United States and some other countries have done. So this is really a week where some significant things have happened. Again, I haven't read the John Jay report, but I'd characterize it this way. In addition to the internal problems that are behind sex abuse by clergy in the church, and by that I mean, first of all, serious sin by individuals, but also failures in management by leadership. In addition to that, there are also external causes and contexts, and it's those external questions that the report basically is trying to center around. So that's, I think, the setup for listeners to understand what that report's about.
Well, there are certain mm-hmm. conclusions. Now this particular center, it's not the first time they have reported on this. In fact, they've done some wonderful work over the years. And the conclusions of the report, I suppose, are that whilst the vast majority of the victims were young men, and we're speaking in terms of 85% and above, and most of those being boys of 13, 14, 15, 16 years old. And they're saying that homosexuality was not the cause and neither was celibacy. Well, as I read about in the book, celibacy certainly isn't the cause. It's ludicrous to think that when celibate, normal celibate men feel lust, they feel lust for an adult woman. Not for a 14-year-old boy. If you don't have a relationship with a woman as a normal man, you don't suddenly become aroused by a 13 or 14-year-old
boy. Well, the hard fact that needs to be confronted directly is that there is apparently a lot of a large presence of homosexual persons within the priesthood.
Well, even on that issue,
there have been varying estimates to how many homosexuals are wearing the Catholic collar these days, and the estimates run from 20% to I've seen one study which asserts it's about 70% or 80%.
Well, I that figure I believe to be ludicrous. Now, it is anecdotal,
but they also, of course, make a distinction between active homosexuality and homosexuality controlled through chastity.
Yes, but beyond that, how would they find those numbers? A lot of these reports are very tendentious. Yeah. I mean, that there are proselytizing people out there who want to say that this is to be found everywhere. I would suggest in the Anglo-Catholic tradition, in the Church of England, you could maybe see 60% to 70%, just my personal observation, anecdotally. In the Roman Catholic Church, no, it's nowhere approaching that, celibate or not. And how would they identify? Would they ask people they wouldn't admit? Are they self-identified as gay men? If so, they wouldn't be in the priesthood. We have to be very, very sensitive to this issue because I'm in media. I know a lot of gay men, and they're appalled by what has gone on. These were men who were homosexual, but they weren't having relationships with grown men. They were having relationships. They were raping, they were abusing young boys who had reached the age of puberty. So it wasn't paedophilia. It was something very specific. And what the report says, and it's very sensitive, is although obviously this was not celibacy being the issue, because if that were the case, why the high rates in the Episcopalian church, in evangelical churches, in the family, much higher? Public education, it's probably three times the rate. Also, they say homosexuality is not the cause. Now, I believe they're being rather politically correct in that. And you have to distinguish between mainstream gay culture and what was going on here. But homosexuality is an issue. There is a connection, at least with these men. They obviously went into the seminaries with this brokenness, this perversion, and then acted on it. But let's remember, and there's a whole chapter on this in the book, and it wasn't fun to write, but we're speaking of maybe 2% of Roman Catholic clergy. The standard response was
2% engaged in
either directly or indirectly in some form of abuse of overwhelmingly young boys. The response generally was, we're going to move you, you mustn't do it again, and you must have counseling, which seems horribly inadequate today. But that was a standard advice given to school boards, to sports teams, to other denominations in those days. If we look at the figures for the past 5 or 6 years, it's something like 8 per year amongst millions of people.
I now have before me on my screen the full report.
Right.
It's just somebody sent it, and I brought it up. And I have the findings in the executive summary, which I propose to read. It's only one longish paragraph when we return after after a newscast almost instantly, and then perhaps some further discussion in response to this official summary of the findings of the study. All of that will follow directly after the update on the news. For that, to the WGN newsroom again and to Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
We are talking about Catholicism and about the Catholic Church. Those are not necessarily exactly the same thing. That is, one is an institution, the other is a faith. Our three guests are involved in both, surely. They are Michael Corrin, whose new book is titled Why Catholics Are Right, Patrick McCloskey, whose book of about 2 years ago, I guess, is titled The Street Starts Here, and the Reverend Thomas Bima, who is the Vice Rector for Academic Affairs at the Mundelein Seminary, which is, of course, the major seminary for this archdiocese. Gentlemen, here then is the findings section of the executive summary of what is a long report. I read, no single, quote, cause of sexual abuse of minors by Catholic priests is identified as a result of our research. Social and cultural changes in the 1960s and 1970s manifested in increased levels of deviant behavior in the general society and also among priests of the Catholic Church in the United States. Organizational, psychological, and situational factors contributed to the vulnerability of individual priests in this period of normative change. The Causes and Context Report provides data about the historical time period of the problem, the increase in incidents until the late 1970s, and the sharp decline by 1985. Although no specific institutional cause for the increase in incidents was found, factors specific to the Catholic Church contributed to the decline in the mid-1980s. Analysis of the development and influence of seminary education throughout the historical period is consistent with the continued suppression of abuse behavior in the 21st century. The priests who engaged in abuse of minors were not found, on the basis of their developmental histories or their psychological characteristics, to be statistically distinguishable from other priests who did not have allegations of sexual abuse against minors. I've read a lot of reports. I've written a few of them. That sounds to me somehow evasive and and disclosing less than one would want.
Oh, very much so. I mean,
what's going on here?
Not very much. It has been lawyered, obviously. It's political. There's one element of it that almost gets to something which is extremely important, and that's the change in teaching and giving in to the surrounding culture. Almost certainly, there would always have been men who went into the seminaries who had a particular perversion. But their formation and their teaching and their commitment to the faith meant that they could never act on that. It would destroy them. They could not. We all have urges. I'm a married man. I love my wife very much. She's way too beautiful for me, really. Am I aware of attractive women? Yes, I have a pulse. I am. But I don't act on that because I've made a commitment. There's a moral core. At a certain period in the seminaries, they were far too influenced by the abuse of Vatican II, not Vatican II, but an abuse of the teachings of Vatican II, mm-hmm. by the surrounding culture, the Woodstock culture, if you like, and men who would have left the priesthood or battled to stop these temptations gave in. They gave in and they abused. So there's an element of truth there, but the rest of it is really just flummery. There's nothing to it. More of the report, as I mentioned earlier, does refer to celibacy and homosexuality. But they do also say, though, and again we've had this figure, and people must realize this. First of all, it's in the past. This is very important to remember. The church is the safest place for a young
what
person.
What measures have been taken to make it a matter of the past rather than the present?
Oh, goodness me. Men who go into the seminaries now are questioned over and over again. A lot of investigation takes place. There was a certain naivety in the past.
A question searching for what?
Deviant behavior, psychological self-perception, ambitions, aspirations.
If you encounter a predilection toward, or indeed an active life until entering the seminary, of the homosexual variety, would that rule the person out or
it
not?
It would make it difficult, not impossible, but difficult, because homosexuality is seen as being a disordered behavior. We're more than just our sexuality. We're more than just sex.
Even chaste homosexuality.
It wouldn't,
a concept which I find rather incomprehensible, but I've encountered it reading materials about that.
Well, I mean, I know people who are gay and will always be gay. They're not priests, but they're celibate because they believe that it's sinful behavior. But there is something within the gay subculture that does emphasize the sexual nature of one's being. The church says we're far more than our sexuality. Yeah. So, you know, you could be, I mean, Father would know better than I, but you could be accepted into a seminary with these feelings, but I think it will be difficult. But when the church said, look, that the overwhelming number of victims were young boys being abused by men, so we must be careful about the sexuality of men going into the seminaries, the church was then accused of homophobia. So whatever it does, it can't win.
Well, as Michael said, most of this is in the past, and that's important to emphasize. I mean, there are people who ask me all the time about sexuality or about sex abuse in the schools, assuming it's an ongoing issue, which it is not. I mean, not merely are there few religious in schools anymore, but seminary training has changed, and everyone is very, very vigilant about that. As well as parents and students are well aware of what to do if anything happens. When I went to Catholic school, there were certainly abusive priests. We just didn't talk about it. We just accepted that was just part of the environment. We just tried to step around it. Now students know to say something, and then the minute an accusation comes up, whoever is accused, their serious actions are taken right away. Mm-hmm. So this is just simply not an issue anymore, or very seldom, let's say.
As you and your colleagues run the Mundelein Seminary, what are your evaluation procedures with regard to making admission or rejection decisions?
Well, there are several levels to that. First of all, there is an evaluation process that's done by each diocese before they send a man to seminary. Most people don't know you can't apply to seminary directly. You have to be sent there by a religious superior or a bishop. And so before they ever get to our admission process, there is a separate and distinct admission process at the diocesan level. And it's done by a person who's called a vocation director. And in the wake of this crisis, which is taken very, very seriously, virtually every vocation director I know understands their first job as to be a line of defense against unsuitable candidates being admitted to
priestly
formation.
But how do you define unsuitability?
Well, unsuitable in the sense of A, being, you know, having a tendency to be a predator, or being so narcissistic that they just care only about themselves and can't be, you know, loving and giving. It's a whole complex thing. Most seminary, I'll speak about Mundelein. At Mundelein Seminary, after the vocation director and the diocese have done their own screening process and felt that they have a candidate they're willing to put forward, we insist on psychological evaluations, and I think every seminary I know does that. A whole battery of diagnostic tests, again, to see if there's any pathology in the person coming in.
I can't resist being a psychologist by training. What diagnostic test do you use?
And I'm not a psychologist, so I can't answer that.
The Minnesota Multiphasic Inventory, things like that?
I'm sure that I've heard the what's the initials of that?
MMPI.
Yes, I've heard them say that, yeah. The other thing, though, is Mundelein insists on personal interviews with every candidate. Where we have three separate admission boards that meet with the candidate. One is an academic board, of course, to check their intellectual preparation. Another is what we call a formation board, which really looks at their spiritual life. Whether there's a depth of spirituality that is appropriate for a man, entering into preparation for the priesthood. But we also have what we call an administrative board, and that looks at their life history and their human development, because we're looking for the kind of maturity that will indicate that this person can be put into a ministerial situation. So, again, we're trying to do our best to do screening at the front end.
Well, look, not to be too crude with it, but directly speaking, suppose you got a young man who looks quite creditable and does well on his MMPI or other such psychological measures, and seems seriously committed to wanting to enter the priesthood, and he says to you in an early interview, "I should tell you, I have been a homosexual. I've never been with women. I have been with men, but I understand I'm not supposed to do that anymore, and that's fine." What would you then do?
That would be a flag that we would have to look at more carefully. We'd have to see whether whether it's an occasional thing or is it part of his structure, of his understanding of himself. But that would put the brakes on the admission process
and would lower the probability of his being admitted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We are about to pause for the usual reason, and there are yet other matters we should be discussing, but I should say to our listeners, we will surely get to the phones, probably not until after the 10:30 break. So, we are opening the lines right now, if you don't mind waiting a bit, and do have a question you want to pose, or an assertion you want to assert briefly. Brevity will be required with the limited time available. At any rate, for any or all such purposes, the number is, of course, 312-591-7200, 312, then 591-7200. And for those listening over the internet at some greater distance, the email, of course, is always available. The email address, extension 720 at WGNradio.com. Extension 720 at WGNradio.com, or the aforesaid 312-591-7200. Right back to the team of McCloskey, Bima, and Corin. After these words, or rather after the update on the news. For that to the newsroom and Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Are we done with this subject, or should we go to something else?
Yes, something else,
what
please.
Else, what, you're an experienced radio and television man. What else, Michael, should we go to?
Well, we're not going to do soccer tonight, so we'll keep to Catholicism. But it's interesting that you asked this, because when I wrote the book, it was in many ways a response to the arguments against the attacks on the church. And it always begins with abuse. People will come up to me and say, "I've got a new argument against the church." And I went, no, you haven't. I've heard them all. But it begins with abuse, and it generally moves on to history, I find.
And with regard to almost modern history, it goes on to the Holocaust and the accusations against pious.
Crusades, Inquisition, Holocaust. The theology comes much later.
Yeah.
And the Crusades, it's laughable in a way. And the word crusade wasn't even used during the Crusades. In the Islamic world, the Crusades were barely even mentioned because they won. And they were aware of this, and they were proud that they had won. It was European writers, German and English, in the 19th century who made the Crusades an issue.
So well, we must remember the Crusaders established the Crusader Kingdom at Akko, which is Acre, still on the coast of Israel,
mm-hmm.
and it lasted for about 100 years.
Yes, and some of the kingdoms longer. There was one very brief attempt to convert Muslims, but overwhelmingly there was no attempt to convert. Islam was always a majority religion. Put it in context, this was the heartland of Christianity. Egypt, Israel, Palestine, Syria, North Africa, the church fathers, the early church. Egypt was a majority Christian country with a Jewish and a pagan minority. And contrary to what maybe PBS documentaries might tell you, Islam did not come in and give out flowers and candy. Islamic cavalry rode in, often forcibly converting. And for hundreds of years, the church did little in response. But it was really when pilgrims and indigenous Christians were being persecuted by a particular brand of Islam that the Crusades took place. They were a military response to Islamic expansionism, and they weren't always nice, as medieval warfare.
But if you're going to deal with history, surely you can't fully avoid the fact that some of the popes were rather odd fellows and lacked a full Christian dedication to do things in a way that squared
Absolutely.
With the standards of goodness and decency.
Oh, yes.
And some of them were quite profligate and had children of their own and so on and so
well,
on and so on.
Actually, if you look at the history of the popes, most of them were really very, very good, but there were some who were absolute stinkers.
The Borgia popes and
so on. Yeah, but there aren't too many. However, what that proves, I think, is another evidence for the church, because we're told that there may be some fallible people who are in that chair, but they won't teach heresy. And even the Borgia pope, he may have been a hypocrite, but he didn't teach heresy. So yes, there have been bad popes, there have been bad people in positions of influence, but the church has not taught heresy and taught error.
I suppose we get general agreement along those lines around the table.
Oh, certainly. Certainly there were bad popes. Let's just start with that. You know, there is no human being on earth today that is exempt from the temptations of sin. And this is why we need a church.
Yep, you know? Exactly.
But, you know, you have to I think what's fascinating, too, about history is it's if you want to read the history of a fascinating history, it's a history of the Catholic Church. Not, you know, it's got all the great elements of a wonderful drama. There's sex, there's violence and all of that sort of thing. But it's a great story of overcoming. I mean, you know, in the 5th century, they're debating whether to one could enslave fellow Christians. And by the year 1000, I think a papal bull went out that if you're attacking your neighbor in Europe, as the serfs and, you know, the warlords did, don't poke up both eyes, don't cut off both hands. You're going to leave them defenseless, that sort of thing. So this is this long, slow recognition and sort of implementation of where Christianity began, about how everyone is worth in the eyes of God the same thing. Ultimately, that flowers into liberal democracy and human rights.
You know, there's also a constant struggle, though, between the church and culture. And Europe was converted several times. Each time it's an encounter with different cultures, and the gospel has to take root again and has to purify and change that culture. So I think we forget that there's an unevenness in history. Mm-hmm. And it's not just a linear progress forward, but there are steps forward, there's falling back, and that's just the nature of how history is.
And at its worst, I think, the church in history has given into or reflected the culture. It's acted as the culture. And what we tend to do today in this rather anachronistic manner is to criticize the church as though it was worse than its surrounding culture. But I would argue that when it's gone wrong in history, the church has simply been part of the culture. But most of its history, it has stood apart from the culture and demanded and requested something better.
Stood apart from the culture more than other brands of Christianity?
Yeah. Oh, far more. Protestantism, bless it. But it's very much a part of the culture, and it has wanted to be one with it. Now, at its best, that's produced Harvard University and Milton. But at its worst, it's what we see today, which is an evangelical...
That's John Milton you're talking about,
yes,
I trust.
Yes. Cromwell's Latin secretary. But we see the evangelical church today, which... it says it's not of the culture, but it is. It's simply an alternative. So evangelical music, evangelical phone engineers, evangelical
What about
candy.
Guitar masses in Catholic churches?
Pardon me?
Guitar masses. They flourish for a while in some Catholic churches.
Well, now, this is to a degree a matter of aesthetics. I can't stand them. However, some of the finest Catholics I've ever met are charismatic Catholics and are Catholics who attend masses with guitars. I would say this, that as a father of four kids, don't try and be fashionable, because they'll come to you and you'll say, where's that CD I bought you 3 months ago? And they'll say, Dad, it was 3 months ago. If I listen to that now, it'll be social suicide. So never try to be hip and trendy as a parent or as a priest. The church is outside and beyond this. And people, especially ordinary people, I come from a working class home, I think they need something grander. We're meant to be worshiping and praising God. We can generally do better than a guitar.
This is too simple, but I've got to do this because time is short. A very direct question, and I put it to Father Bima. Is Gary Wills a Catholic? You want to explain why I'm asking that?
Go ahead. You can go ahead.
Well, he's done a number of books. He says he's a member. He is a member of a congregation up there in Evanston someplace. And he has conveyed essential disdain for the whole structure of the Catholic Church, for the Pope and even for priests. He says, essentially, ours is a democratic church, and it's important that we can do what we want with the old liturgy, but we can also improvise and invent our own. But basically, there is no ecclesiastic authority which comes down from on high and orders our lives.
As a priest, the way I approach the question, I don't want to speak for him, but as a priest, the way I approach the question, who's a Catholic? Has the person been baptized, received into full communion with the Catholic Church? If so, there's a sacramental bond between us, and that's permanent, that's eternal. Now, that initiation has to be maintained, and it's maintained by a person continuing to believe the faith and remaining in communion, in union with the church that initiated them. I think what I would say is there are degrees of that second. People are more or less in communion, both in their beliefs and in their practices and that. You have people who are baptized Catholics but who are not attending Mass. They would call them impractical. They are not practicing. So in the Catholic mindset, you know, there are degrees of relationship that people have. As a priest, though, I always have to start with not the hard and fast question of who's in and who's out, but where are you and how can you come closer to the ideal of being fully in communion?
It's about the immortal soul, and he's a man of influence, and he's leading people astray. If I say I'm a Republican, but I vote Democrat and I support Democrat policies, I'm not a Republican. If you completely, not only disregard, but actively and aggressively reject the teachings of the church and the authority of the church, which gives us the truth, then you're really a Protestant. I mean, this is what it means. And have the courage then to join a Protestant church. I admire you for that, but don't pretend to be what you're evidently not anymore.
Gentlemen, with that, we pause for the update on the news, which I announced 15 minutes earlier than it was due. But now it is truly due, and then after that, we are due to go directly to the phones and to the email. 312-591-7200 is how you reach us on the phone. If you have a question or a comment, get in there very quickly, and you may get through. If you hit the busy signal, then, of course, the proper strategy is to call again after we say goodnight to a prior caller. And on to the first soon-to-be prior caller after the update on the news, and that, indeed, from Paula Cooper.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And quickly and directly to the phones for your questions to Michael Corrin, Patrick McCloskey, and the Reverend Thomas Bima. 312-591-7200. And Jim has joined us. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Good evening. My question would be, in that report it says 72% of the people who committed sexual abuse were between the ages of 25 and 29. And my question would be, is this a sign of psychosexual non-development because of the people who went into the priesthood maybe right out of high school into college and didn't develop themselves psychosexually? And then questions, like you mentioned, Father Bema asking, or becoming red flags would give people the idea to lie about that so they continue not to develop psychosexually and understand themselves and how to be celibate, whether they're homosexual, heterosexual. When I say a number like 72% of the people who did it were between 25 and 29 when they were ordained, I think that's the biggest scary number in the whole report.
I don't know if it does say that, actually. When they were ordained in that age, or they committed the offense?
The age of ordination was 25 to 29, so they did it later, but they were ordained at a very 72% of the cases were, or of the people who committed the crime were ordained when they were 25 to 29, which I think would...
What is the average... Father Bynum, what's the average age for ordination, would you say?
Well, it can't be before 25. That's a bottom cutoff. And so what the caller is describing really reflects the situation of back then, when a man would enter a high school seminary, go 4 years to high school. He would go to a college seminary, go 4 years there, and then go on to the graduate seminary, the kind I teach on, for another 4 years. And then you're 25 years old and you're ordained. During that period, so prior to the reforms of seminary education, there really wasn't any tremendous screening at the various breakpoints. A person entered and they just kind of continued through. And that's the biggest change that has happened as a result of this horrible crisis, is that serious screening and admission processes have been put into place. But those numbers simply reflect the average age, you know, back then.
But there's a good point here, though, because even beyond sexual abuse, in Ireland, for example...
hey, how's it going?
A priest who were not sexually abusive, but simply were not good. They weren't good priests. They were quite abusive men. They were physically violent because they had been pushed, perhaps, by family pressure into the seminary. They'd never known a life outside. I don't know if you'd agree, but some of the finest priests I've met are people who had relatively late vocations, who have some life experience, and they bring... But it's a good point being made, psychosexually and in every other way. If you've known nothing else at all, you may be tremendous, but the chance of you being flawed are probably higher, but that system, thank the Lord, is gone.
Yeah. And Father makes a good point about the minor seminaries, because I went to one myself. Young men after grade 8 would go into a minor seminary, so really being groomed from that point on, which is very young.
Yeah. Our thanks
now,
to
one
the caller.
Difference today is that the average age of seminary of entrance to the major seminary is 35 across the nation.
Really?
So there's
so
a typical significant shift.
A typical vocation is a late vocation.
Yeah.
These days.
Now at Mundelein, our average age is a little bit lower. It's around 29-30. But you see that still is later.
Lower in Canada too.
Yeah. The one thing I've observed, I've been in seminary education now for 11 years of the 31 years that I've been ordained. And the one thing I've observed is that there seems to be a correlation that men approach entrance to seminary about the same time their age cohort begins to get engaged for marriage. So I'm just describing what I see, not drawing a conclusion.
Let's go back to the phones. 312-591-7200. One or two lines available now. If you've been trying to reach us, do try again. And John has reached us. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. My question was, when I was a young boy, my dad would always take me to a Catholic church, so I've got a lot of that background in me. But my question is, I do admire the Catholic Church for sticking to, the points of, anti-abortion and against gay rights.
Not against gay rights. So, gay people have all the rights of everyone else, but against same-sex marriage.
Okay, I appreciate that correction. But another point I was kind of contemplating was, I'm kind of in a quandary about organ donation, but the present Pope, hasn't he condoned that in certain circumstances? And can you kind of explain how the Catholic Church has not surrendered to the world on abortion and, gay rights and that kind of thing?
Well, abortion is about the protection of unborn life. Organ donation is about the preservation of life. I mean, it's about life, so there's no contradiction there.
No, but what I'm saying is, a lot of the other churches, the Baptists and stuff, they kind of, surrender to the world so they can get more people in their churches and things like that. But the Catholic Church doesn't seem to have you know, taking that point of view.
I don't think the evangelical church has surrendered to the world to get more people in. I mean, some do, some don't. But organ donation is simply what it is. It's organ donation. If the body can be used with respect to help other people, abortion is about also respect for the human person at the unborn stage. So I don't think there's any contradiction.
Well, I mean, isn't organ donation, though, sort of man's way of trying to be immortal in a sense?
No. No, it's about respect for life, caring for life, and helping people when there's no harm done to the person donating the organ. It's up to the individual.
But isn't at one time the Roman Catholic Church was against dissection of the body, like back when Da Vinci was around?
Well, not at that period. At a certain time, the church was, but it changed its position. But it's never been against organ donation, really, because obviously that's a modern possibility.
The issue only arises in recent times.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, thank you.
We thank you, sir, for the call. 312-591-7200. And Dan is next up. Good evening, sir.
Yes, hello, Milt. One of the questions I have, which are many, but I'll just ask one tonight, of course. If the Roman Catholic Church is right, I would debate that based on the history and going specifically to the subject of the long centuries of the Inquisitions. How can the Catholic Church be right over a period of, say, the year 1200 approximately to, and even in the 1800s, Inquisitions continue?
Well.
And people are suffering by the thousands, countless thousands are being tortured. And is the Catholic Church right? Is it being taught to be right today? Have they?
Well, your dates are wrong, sir. There was no Inquisition in there were many Inquisitions. You're probably the one we normally refer to is the Spanish Inquisition, because nobody expects a Spanish Inquisition. The average person in Europe saw the Inquisition once every 30 years. There were criminals who were blasphemed because they would want to go before the Inquisition to have a legal representation. It's a complex issue. Spain was an emerging nation state. There was fear of those who had converted, but not properly.
But who were they? They were God's children who were being persecuted.
Well, what do you mean?
Jews were being persecuted, who are God's children.
Yeah, we're all God's children. But you see, if you want a conversation about this, we can. But I think what you're doing, with all due respect, is you're giving us Hollywood mythology here.
This is not mythology.
Could I explain to you what happened? I don't know which history books you read.
Let's hear an explanation.
Well,
will you allow me to, then?
Is the Catholic Church
right?
Yes.
The Inquisition spanned decades and centuries. Thousands of women.
Will you allow me to respond?
Let me ask the question.
You should now allow him to respond.
They're burned at the stake.
The Inquisition
didn't.
They're
tortured.
This is why I wrote the book, Catholics Are Right, because we have to put up with people who, again, with all due respect, don't know the situation, but you make things up.
Well, sir, the truth is truth. The truth is truth, but also civility is civility. You're being a bit uncivil. Calm down and be quiet and take. You ask what is truth, but you do not stay for an answer. Now, here's the answer.
Well, Mill, you've heard it too.
Well,
let's go.
If I can't respond, there's no point in having this discussion. If I can respond, now I speak of someone who is Jewish. Three of my grandparents were Jewish. Please do not tell me about Jewish persecution. Spain was a complex country where you had many, many Jewish people, some of whom converted, conversos. There were others known as Maranos who converted, but it wasn't a genuine conversion. Now, they were in a very difficult position because if they didn't become Catholic with the merging of state and church, they weren't allowed full equality. So we can understand why they did what they did. Torquemada, for example, came from a Jewish family. The vast majority of people who went before the Inquisition were told, off you go, you've done nothing wrong. But I don't think the Inquisition could be approved of. But you have to understand, you had a new state, Spain, Catholic Spain, that was under threat of invasion from Islamic powers, where people had opened the gates to Spain to the enemy time and time again, and there was a panic. The Inquisition in Italy, for example, didn't act in such a way. Where we didn't have the Inquisition, such as in England, people were hung, drawn, and quartered for very little reason at all. There was no Inquisition in Central Europe, in Bohemia, and so on. We had the 30 Years' War. I'm not saying it was appropriate. But compared to what other countries were doing, the Inquisition did not stand out in any way. The reason we know so much about it is because of anti-Catholic bias.
With that, we'll thank the caller, and we are required to pause for a quick round of commercial messages, of commercial modules, so to speak. entrepreneurial modules, in fact, and then we'll be directly back.
Milt Rosenberg and Extension 720 on 720 WGN.
And it is time for a confession. Mea culpa. Mea maxima culpa.
Maxima culpa.
Because I've talked about the books of Michael Coren and Patrick McCloskey, but we've said nothing about the book edited by Reverend Thomas Beimer. What is a parish? Canonical, pastoral, and theological perspectives. This is a set of papers from a conference, I gather.
Yes, it actually was a somewhat remarkable conference. The brains behind it was Father Michael Swinney, the president of the Dominican School of Philosophy and Theology out in Berkeley. And he gathered together some of the top scholars in North America, including at least one Canadian scholar, to really look at what is the most fundamental structure of the Catholic Church in most people's experience, their local parish. But to look at it and examine it from all different sides. How do we understand it theologically? What are the legal questions around it, civil and canon? And what does it provide for us pastorally? So it was an amazing conference. In the course of the conference, someone said, "Well, this is just really great, but are we going to publish these things?" And so I approached Father Sweeney and said, "Well, if you don't have anybody else, I'll be glad to take up the task and compile it and publish it as a book," which we succeeded in doing just 2 weeks ago. It's hot off the press.
So it's published by whom?
Hillenbrand Books of Liturgy Training Publication here in Chicago.
And what was clarified at that conference?
The main clarification is to really see how the parish is so central to Catholic life, yet it's rarely reflected on. Most of our theology deals, much more up in the sky. We talk a lot about the universal church. We talk about the local church being the diocese, that collection of communities around a bishop. But we haven't done a great deal of work talking about the nature of what for most Catholics is their main experience, the local parish church.
Well, speaking about local parish churches, let's turn directly to the Chicago scene. And the most interesting parish event recently, namely St. Sabina's and the standoff between Father Flager and Cardinal George. What do you have to say about that?
You want me to comment on this?
I'm looking directly at you, yes.
Well, I think it goes back to some of what we were talking about before, is that a Catholic, and certainly a parish, is not autonomous. None of us as Catholics are autonomous. We are part of a community of faith, and we are bound to that community of faith by our faith, the Apostles' Creed. You asked me to recite at the very beginning. So by our faith, by the sacramental life we share with one another in that ecclesial community, and by ecclesiastical governance, by our being led and pastored by successors of the apostles. That's the Catholic life. And so, any Catholic and any community of Catholics has to function within that. So regardless of the parish, whether you look at the parish that I serve at or whether you look at St. Sabina's, we have to maintain those bonds of communion.
Well, Father Flager's had a very close relationship to his parish for quite a number of years. He stayed longer than priests usually do in one particular church, I gather. They are up in arms, apparently, if one is to believe the news stories about it. They are very, very upset that their priest is being taken away. Should the cardinal, should the archbishop be yielding to them on that basis?
This is a situation between the bishop and one of his priests, and I don't really think it's appropriate for me as a priest, to enter in and comment on that. Father Flager and Cardinal George are in conversation about it, and I really can't say more than
it's
that.
It's very difficult for you to do so, but as a foreigner, as a Canadian, I will say what I think. He was meant to present them with the Church, Christ, the Church of Christ, not himself. And that they are up in arms is because he has presented himself as this charismatic figure instead of presenting himself as merely
and also as a social theorist. He's very left-wing very excited in his denunciatory skills.
I think he has tried to adopt the culture of the parish in a way. not fraudulent, that would be too aggressive, but I think it's rather manipulative. But we've seen this with other priests, of right and left. They give a congregation themselves rather than merely being a conduit for something greater, mm-hmm. which is the church, and that's colossal arrogance.
I also think that, Father, that underlying this to some extent is a feeling among African-American Catholics of being somewhat ignored by the church.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of runs through the 3 million black Catholics through the
Let me go back to the phones. Time is very short, and here's an interesting question from George. Good evening, sir.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, Milt. My question to the panel is, I read an article where the Muslim population over the next 50 to 100 years is growing at a very rapid pace, and I'm wondering what effect that's going to have on the Catholic Church 50 to 100
years
from now.
Yes, and let me just add something to that. Michael and I have a mutual friend, indeed. He's been on both of our separate programs, mm-hmm. Mark Stein,
yep.
whose book, America Alone, about 5 years ago now, really just takes the demographic data and demonstrates that Europe is going under. The Catholic Church is going under. It doesn't have all that many serious communicants anymore, and they are not reproducing in kind. And he predicts demographically the Islamic population, which will continue to come in terms of further immigration, will also expand tremendously by virtue of a very high birth rate, so that predictably, you can envision a Europe, a West Europe, or some of the countries in Western Europe who will have virtually Islamic majorities rather than Catholic or Christian majorities.
The problem, though, and I agree with Mark to a large extent, but there's one of consistent analysis. Many Muslims will assimilate, become part of the Western culture, have fewer children, maybe leave their religion. The Netherlands is a major issue. Parts of Scandinavia, particularly Sweden, are major issues. This is not going to happen in Britain and France and Germany, and particularly in France. The French aren't as nice as the British. The French are beginning to turn around and take certain actions and measures to respond to this. But if people carry on having 1.2 children, aborting their children, contracepting, then there will be a response, a reaction, a result of that. But it doesn't change the truth of the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, I think it might make the church grow because people will turn to the only alternative.
Why are the French, however, losing their deep commitments to the faith of the Roman Catholic Church? If you go to Notre Dame, even on a Sunday morning,
it's empty.
Well, it's not totally empty. There are a lot of American tourists.
Exactly. France is it. Spain as well. Ireland, 50-50.
Italy
now.
As well.
Italy. I mean, France has always had an issue, though, with secularism. And this goes mm-hmm. back to the 1870s, to the 1780s.
Well, we have virtually no time left, but I'm very interested in further response on that question. Is the Catholic faith being maintained in Europe?
France is experiencing some revival in monasticism. And the monasteries are the leading edge of revival. So I would just say that there are other factors at work for the future.
I think the challenge, well, I'll get away from Europe and back here. The challenge in America is not Islam for the Catholic Church, but the wave of Hispanic immigrants. The percent of Catholics is rising dramatically. We could be at close to 40-50% Catholic in the middle of the century, and the issue is whether or not, for the church's point of view, whether they will remain Catholic is only 3%
well,
of the children.
Well, in fact, Hispanic influx, we would not be maintaining ourselves at a replacement level, which recalls for 1.2 births per family.
Mm-hmm.
But it is important to recognize that the Catholic Church is growing dramatically in the Southern Hemisphere.
Sorry, I said 1.2. I should have said 2.1 is a replacement level.
Mm-hmm. Catholic Church is growing dramatically in other parts of the world, particularly the Southern Hemisphere.
In South America, we are told.
And Africa.
Gentlemen, we're out of time. There are many questions still unanswered, indeed unasked, but we've gone as far as we could go. Given the constraints, and I am very much in your debt. I've enjoyed this tremendously, as I think have our listeners. Michael Corrin and Patrick McCloskey and the Reverend Thomas Vima have been our guests. A few very quick words about things to come. We'll be here tomorrow for the full 2 hours, and we're going to be talking with two authors, both of whom have done books that essentially address the question of why the Civil War broke out when it did and how it did. And really, the question even behind that is, was that war necessary or could it have been avoided? It's a case of really doing counterfactual history or counterfactual speculation. And we will turn then to the early days of the American Civil War in conversation tomorrow night. With that, we'll wind down for this night with a quick urge urging to you that you check out the website for podcasts, the website being extension 720 at rather WGNradio.com/extension720. And running a little late, thanks to all and a most cordial good night.